Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded. Please be seated.
Good morning. We're delighted to welcome today. Students from Mishicot High School, would they please stand?
Good group.
Is anybody left at home? You may be seated. We're delighted to see you. We also have with us people I've been expecting for a day, but who finally arrived. Department of Justice externs, do we have them here? Are they still on my list and don't on no shows? Are they here? Would they stand, please? We're delighted to see you. Are you law students or undergraduate students?
Law students.
Good. Well, welcome. You may be seated, too. The high school students are here with us under a program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court and State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite high school students from around the state to come and listen to an oral argument and then meet with a justice at noon. And this is a national award-winning program. We have had thousands of high school students with us, and they get copies of the brief of the case we are about to hear, and may have done some extra activities on this case. Now, I don't know if the Department of Justice externs have gotten material on the case. Have they? Okay, fine. For anyone else in the courtroom, if you would like a summary of the case, the marshal will give you a summary if you raise your hand. All right. I assume everybody is prepared, but we will not ask you questions other than counsel. Let me introduce the court to you. Before I do that, let me say that everyone is invited to come to the noon session. The discussion will be the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases, not the substance of this case, not the substantive issues in this case. So I will start on my far right, Justice Patience Robensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will do the noon presentation with the whoever wants to come. And to my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we are going to call our first case, which is 04AP2820 CR, State versus Roger S. Walker. Representing Mr. Walker is James A. Repholz. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, as a sort of a preamble in preparing my remarks today and reviewing the file and thinking back to when I began my representation of Mr. Walker more than 2 years ago, thinking through the process that was necessarily required in determining whether there was any merit in his trial court record, considering the resentencing motion and then following that, the order granting the resentencing, and following that, the decision denying the modification by the circuit court, and then deciding whether and how to proceed from the circuit court's decision denying modification of sentence, and then in preparing the notice of appeal. The procedural steps along the way and the different decisions that had to be made seemed far less troublesome and the process far more seamless than it appeared as I began tackling those issues for this court on the briefs. Nevertheless, Mr. Walker believes that the Court of Appeals should have and should be able to review his sentencing claim on the merits for three reasons. The first reason is that Mr. Walker believes that he has substantially complied with the holding in State v. Meyer. He believed that he complied with that holding when he returned to the Green Lake Circuit County Circuit Court and asked the court to review its sentencing decision. The document which was filed in the circuit court provided various grounds upon which the circuit court could review the sentence and should review the sentence. And when the court agreed to review a sentence, Mr. Walker believed that his obligation under Meyer was satisfied. Nothing in the Meyer decision appeared to categorically bar appellate review on the merits, given the circuit court's review, given its review of its discretionary decision, and given its subsequent refusal to modify Mr. Walker's prison sentence and consecutive prison structure.
Mr. Rebholz,
yes, sir.
Let me ask you a question so that I'm clear in my own mind. You've talked about the judge's refusal to modify the sentence. Now, it's my understanding that what happened here was that both sides, the state and defense, agreed that there should be resentencing. The judge agreed to resentence based on apparently incorrect medical information. And what occurred, as I understand it, was resentencing. In other words, the judge said, okay, we're going to set aside that sentence. We're now going to look at what is an appropriate sentence. And the sentence turned out to be the same, 12 years. Is that not correct?
It's partially correct and partially not correct, and here's why I think that. The request for resentencing was based on several different reasons. And as happens in all of these cases, the different reasons sort of merge and separate depending on how the issue is addressed and how it's resolved. And by that I mean we alternatively pled a motion to modify the sentence in the circuit court. And if Judge McMonagle had reviewed our documents and simply said that I either find that there's not a new factor here or I find a new factor but there's no reason to change my sentence, then it would have been a review of his sentencing discretion and it would also have been a resentencing, but it sort of has a dual nature. And I hope I've answered the question. It was called a resentencing, but it was called a resentencing because the judge rather arbitrarily, with the help of counsel, chose to call it a resentencing rather than a hearing on the motion to modify or change or reduce Mr. Walker's sentence.
Well, am I not correct that both sides agreed that there should be resentencing?
Well, resentencing in the sense that the judge should take a look at things and reevaluate his sentence. It took on a different nature, and that's why I think partially we're here when it was called resentencing rather than a hearing on the motion to modify the sentence.
Did the judge look at factors that he had not looked at the first time? My recollection is that there's some discussion about the adjustment of your client in prison and a number of other things that were not considered at the original sentencing after revocation of probation. Isn't that correct?
Well, the only new issue that was presented to the Green Lake County Circuit Court was the credit that we believe Mr. Walker was entitled to for his time in a community confinement and not in a jail cell. But other than that, the judge reviewed everything in the so-called resentencing that the judge reviewed in the sentencing hearing itself, although as it developed, the information, part of the information that he relied on at sentencing was incorrect and inaccurate and unreliable.
That was medical information having to do with the victim.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was It was a substantial portion of the sentencing hearing, and it was established in the Fond du Lac proceedings that it was medically unsubstantiated and incorrect and should not have been presented in that form to the Green Lake Circuit Court.
Mr. Repholz, I'm not sure that I understand why you object to the characterization of the proceeding as a resentencing as opposed to a motion for sentence modification. It would seem to me that a resentencing would strengthen your argument that this should be under 80930 sub 2 as opposed to a motion for modification, which I think would strengthen the state's argument that this should come under 973-19.
Well, as a matter of fact, we did proceed under 80930, and as a matter of fact, it was termed as sentencing. And for both of those reasons, we think that Meyer was substantially complied with. If we had proceeded under 973, I don't think we'd be in a relatively a position as we believe we are today.
Well, Mr. Repholz, can I ask a question about the information that was received and used in the sentencing by, let's say, Judge McMonagle?
Of course.
Yeah. Didn't he, and I think you partially answered Justice Crooks's question, but maybe I missed your answer. On this new medical information, was that was used in the so-called modification or resentencing, wasn't it? Was that used there?
Yes, it was used at both the sentencing and at the resentencing. Yeah.
But what was it, the same or different information?
Well, it was the, if I can just explain a little further, I hope, bear with me. Mr. Walker was convicted of anally sexually assaulting a minor boy in both Green Lake County and Fond du Lac County. In Fond du Lac County, in both counties, the court heard information regarding I suppose you'd call it a diagnosis of encopresis, mm-hmm. medical encopresis. The finding of encopresis was used in the Green Lake County court to aggravate, as an aggravating factor at sentencing, because it apparently caused bowel problems and other medical problems in the unfortunate young victim involved in this case. What happened in Fond du Lac is that the case went to trial, and a medical doctor came in with considerable experience in this area specifically, and he testified that there was no encopresis that was related in any way to the sexual assault. And so there was a hand in glove, far more than most cases I'm involved in, a situation in which the information provided in one court was 100% overcome in another court.
And I thought that information was the information that was used in before Judge McMonagle in Green Lake to change, this was your argument,
yes, sir,
to change his sentence.
That was presented to Judge McMonagle and said that...
that was different. This is my interpretation, but that's...
Okay.
That was different. In other words, the judge then hearing, or your position, judge, here's why we want to change this, is modification or resentencing, and this is, I don't want to call it new information, but something that was developed that you thought would be helpful to your client.
Yes, and it was the perfect equivalent, though, also of a new factor if we had presented it as a new factor.
But whatever, it was used at this so-called, you don't want to use the word, resentence. It
yes,
was
sir.
Used there.
Yes, the judge considered it.
So that's the question. So then there was new information. This is what provided to the judge that was different than his prior sentence.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
So that answers my question. And that's one of the concerns I had was whether he was simply doing lip service or there was actually new information. The fact that he gave the same sentence seems to me to be different than what he actually heard. So he heard something different, but he still gave the same sentence.
Yes, he specifically found that the sentence previously imposed was appropriate, and it was appropriate again.
But he could have used, and I don't know, I mean, this is, you can correct me, he obviously examined it, used different or the same factors, and came to the same conclusion based on different information that he was provided.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, so suppose instead of doing what you did, you went back and you sought a reconsideration of the sentence, made a motion under 97406 to reconsider the sentence, okay? Which is what the state, I gather, wants you to do. Is that right?
Well, it isn't clear to me exactly what the state wants me to do, but...
Okay, but the concept is, if I understand it correctly, and the Assistant Attorney General will correct me, they think you should have gone back to the trial court, whatever procedure you use, go back to the trial court and ask the trial court to reconsider this because you think the trial court made a mistake or didn't, whatever.
And the sentence was too harsh.
Too harsh, okay. So suppose you did that and you went back to the trial court and now the trial court looks at it again and says, okay, 11 years, 6 months. Right? Now what do you have to do? You got a new sentence. Do you have to go back to the trial court again and reconsider the 11 years and 6 months? Or can you go right up on appeal?
My argument would be, and our position is, that should the circuit court on resentencing or review of its sentence change the sentence, as either Judge McMonigle said he could do and sort of threatened to do, that he could have raised it, or should the court reduce it, but reduce it not sufficiently for the defendant's purposes, which your example would be,
right,
then it seems to me as though the holding in Meyer may require that you return to the court and seek another review of that decision.
And how long do we do this?
Well,
anytime there's a change, we keep having to go back to the trial court.
The only thing we're able to present to the court in support of our position is that, consistent with what happened in the Walker scenario in Green Lake County, is that once the court does not change, either increase or reduce the core of the sentence, at that point there is no further obligation on the criminal defendant to return to the circuit court.
But why is that? You've got a different transcript. Strike that. You've got a different, okay, yes, your record is different. The judge was presented different situations. He still came down with the same sentence. As you indicated, there were different factors that were brought before the judge. So why wouldn't you want to return there? Because he came to the same conclusion. I think the Chief Justice is talking about, well, if it's more or less, you might return, but you're saying, well, because it's the same, you don't have to. Have I misstated your argument?
No. That because...
But the appellate court... Okay, strike that.
Because the judge reimposed the same sentence, it seems as though the holdings in Meyer, which don't bar appellate review specifically on a resentencing, and the holding in Norwalk, in which the appellate court found that Mr. Norwalk was entitled to a new trial, and he was retried and then resentenced, we believe that you have to return to the court following that sentencing, and in Scaccio, if I'm saying it properly, we feel as though the Walker situation is consistent with the holding in Scaccio because he was put on probation and sentence withheld, and then when he was revoked and ultimately sentenced, Mr. Scaccio was obligated to return to the court and have that sentence reviewed.
But what about the Spaneth case? You've got a situation there where this court said, and admittedly a long time ago, but this court said, the right procedure, unless you've got compelling circumstances to justify it, is to go back to the trial court first. If the trial court denies your motion for sentence modification, then you go up the appellate ladder. And my understanding is that the Court of Appeals said that even with the change in the appellate procedure rules in the Lynch case, that things haven't changed. You still need compelling circumstances. What are the compelling circumstances that would justify here going immediately to the Court of Appeals and not back to the Circuit Court?
We feel as though there are three compelling circumstances. The first one is that the Green Lake County Court accepted that its sentence was based on inaccurate sentencing information and that, excuse me, a review was necessary. Two, the court then made that review and exercised its discretion manifested in the court's specific words that its sentence was appropriate then and its sentence is appropriate now. And thirdly, that the procedural requirements of 80932 B, H, and J were only implicated because the court chose, with the party's agreement, to resentence Mr. Walker rather than simply holding a hearing on whether or not the sentence should be changed based on the unreliability and inaccuracy of the earlier sentencing. And fourth, that Mr. Walker's appeal from the resentencing hearing was effectively accomplished consistent with 80932 B, H, and J. So those are our compelling reasons.
Mr. Repholz, I have two questions. One, if I can follow up Justice Crook's question regarding the Spanoff case. Does Spanoff apply here? As I understood Spanoff, that was a 97406 post-conviction procedure, not an 80930 motion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So is this Spanoff directly on point, or are we going to have to analogize based upon its holding and decide which way we want to go?
Right. Well, we don't believe that it is correct because we specifically pursued the statutory option of 80930.
And then that gets me to my next question, which is a factual question. I mean, with respect to the motion that was filed in the trial court, the motion itself wasn't attached to the brief. Was the sentencing issue the sole issue that was presented in the 80930 motion, or were there other issues that were raised that were abandoned on appeal?
Sentencing was the only issue presented.
Now, let's see.
As I mentioned earlier, it was presented in various forms, but it was sentencing. I'd like to make just a few comments on, I'm sorry.
Let me just ask you, see if I understand the facts. He was put on probation by Judge McMonigle, right?
That's correct.
The probation was revoked and there had to be a sentencing, correct?
Yes, that's it.
And McMonigle gave him 12 years.
Correct.
So that was one sentence hearing. Then we find out about the harm to the victim and you go in and ask for resentencing. Instead of resentencing, the sentence is vacated, in effect, and we start the proceeding again. Okay, that's two. And the state's, and so then you appealed, and the Court of Appeals wants you to go back to McMonigle for a third time. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And you don't want to do that?
It's not that we don't want to as much as that it seems as though it's unnecessary. Secondly, that it would not serve any purpose because of the way Judge McMonigle phrased his language in his decision.
Well, but the opposite view is you now have a new sentencing by this judge, and if you think the judge erred, the goal is to let the trial court judge correct its own mistake, if there is one, rather than to go to the Court of Appeals so that the trial court can take more testimony, can consider evidence, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the theory. So does it work in this case? That's what my real problem is. Because if it works, then we ought to stick with the theory. If it doesn't work, then we ought to reexamine that theory and see if the theory applies here.
Well, it doesn't seem to work to us and requires a clarification or modification of the holding in Meyer because of, I think, the, the Walker sentencing scenario was a pristine example of where a return to the circuit court would have been a waste of scant judicial resources and the resources of other agencies which are involved as well.
I have another question. Suppose, you know, after you got the Court of Appeals decision, can't you go back to the trial court and say to McMonigal, it's a do-over. Do-over, I'm now making the right motion. The Court of Appeals said so. I assume you have time. That's my real question. You have time to do that. And if you don't, then my question is, do you have that, then time to go again to the Court of Appeals and to this court? Or has one of your time periods run out?
Well, certainly 973-19 is not available because the transcripts were requested, although it was a resentencing. And by the time the Court of Appeals addressed our issue, it was beyond, I think it's 90 days so that wasn't available to us.
Right.
Now, whether or not I should have requested the Court of Appeals for a reconsideration and asked to withdraw the appeal itself so that I could return to the circuit court, that never occurred to me. And I pressed on because I believed at that point that that we were not barred by Meyer and so on.
Well, suppose you lose here. Are you going to be barred from going back to McMonigal and say, hey, do over. Glad to see you again, Ms. Judge McMonigal, but have to do it again, and then I'm going to, if you don't give me, I mean, the unspoken word, if you don't give me less than 12 in a significant amount, I'm going to go back up.
Well, there's conceivably an opportunity under 974-06 to go back.
Is there a constitutional violation for that?
Yes, you do. And the constitutional violation would be my ineffectiveness in not having properly followed the rules. I would have to return to the state public defender, prepare a memo, and ask them to appoint somebody else to go back on 974-06 and address the issue in that fashion. I was trying to preserve resources, I think, when I went to this court following the Court of Appeals review.
Mr. Repholz, when the 12-year sentence was imposed a second time, did Judge McMonigal advise the defendant what to do next?
I don't remember, and I think the court's specifically referring to whether or not the court advised him about his appellate opportunities. And if that's the court's question, I can't say. The court was obligated to do that. I can't say whether it happened or not. I'm assuming that it did because the courts are pretty good about that, but maybe the court didn't.
What I'm really trying to get at is whether the court said anything that could cause the appeal to be filed rather than a motion for a reconsideration. I mean, basically, I think what you're saying is that the decision to appeal was entirely your own.
Well, the decision to appeal was primarily my client's, and I
we remember
working on his behalf. But in terms of whether or not to return, we scrutinized the sentencing transcript, and the words of Judge McMonigal are, in my mind, strong and clear, and that is, my sentence was appropriate then, and my sentence is appropriate now. And that seemed to us to be exercising his discretion a second time. And that is, of course, the court holding of Meyer and the other cases to give the circuit court, appropriately so, a crack at its earlier sentence and see whether or not there's anything important enough in what happened to make any changes. And we believe that's what happened here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Weinstein.
Thank you. My name is Warren D. Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Wisconsin, representing the state in this appeal. I want to make a distinction based on a couple of things, although they were, they appeared to me to be side comments, but nonetheless, Mr. Rebholz on two occasions mentioned new factor. This is not a new factor case. New factor does not figure into this procedure at all. It's a totally separate proceeding based on the inherent authority of the court. But there is a lot of confusion in the case law that molds it into this procedure we're talking about now. But it's not involved in this case, and this was not a new factor case. In my view,
Mr. Weinstein, if the court had categorized its ruling as a denial of a motion to modify a sentence as opposed to sentencing and vacate, would the state still be of the position that Mr. Rebholz would have had to have gone back to the trial court?
In my view, if the court had done that, it would have been a mischaracterization of what went on in the trial court. I don't specifically remember whether or not there was a separate claim in the post-conviction motion that clearly set out whether or not the Walker was calling into question the exercise of discretion of the trial court. If there was, it was not reached in the trial court. The sole ground upon which the court decided the first post-conviction motion was the fact that the court had used inaccurate information. It wasn't pled that way. It was pled as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, but all the parties in the court treated it as a straight due process claim, and the court granted the motion, which is not technically a motion to modify. It's a post-conviction motion, and resentenced. And in my view, that's really the key to this case. The court, whether it used the same facts or not, although it didn't in this case, and whether or not it used the same reasons, that was a separate, independent exercise of discretion by the trial court setting a second sentence. And I think in those situations, even the situation that the Chief Justice posed prior, that requires going through the procedure again. Anytime the court enters a new judgment, it seems to me that triggers 80930 procedures, and you have to file a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief.
It was a
follow-up.
Go ahead.
If I could follow up on that, Mr. Weinstein, because I am concerned about the ramifications of what we do here today with respect to this decision. We've heard from Mr. Rebholz that only sentencing was addressed in the post-conviction motion. If we had instead a denial of a suppression motion being raised, sufficiency of the evidence, and material misinformation of sentencing, three issues raised, and the trial court denies the motion to suppress, the trial court denies the sufficiency of the evidence claim, but the court agrees that there's material misinformation in sentencing and orders a resentencing. And then same facts, rules the same sentence. How many appeals will we have coming up and from what?
One. And it will be, well, it will depend on the defendant, but it will be, it will also depend on what he does after. But let's assume that he files a motion, another post-conviction motion, that addresses only the second exercise of discretion. Then it seems to me that the issues that are available to him on appeal are sufficiency of the evidence, which he's not required to file any motion for at any time, or the second exercise of discretion. If he included a third issue that didn't have anything to do with sentencing but also required a post-conviction motion, let's say it's ineffective assistance of trial counsel for some evidentiary problem. If he's filed a post-conviction motion the first time and doesn't renew it, I think he can still appeal because under 80930, that's an issue that's already been raised. What hasn't been raised here is the second exercise of discretion.
But I guess my concern, and the reason I asked the question, is if he has to start over from the resentencing, it's the state's position that raising these issues the first time around in the first 80930 would satisfy going back to the trial court so you wouldn't have to refile an 80930 on the denial of suppression motion. Is that correct? I mean, that's the concern that I have, is just what, how many times do you have to go back and what for?
Let me answer it this way, because I'm not sure I totally understand the question. If either in a prior post-conviction motion or at trial, an issue which the defendant wants to appeal has been presented to the circuit court, then I think either under Meyer, which completely separate from 809-30, or under 973-19-1B, which incorporates the 809-30 procedure, the defendant does not have to file another post-conviction motion as to that issue. The problem here is that Walker treated the second exercise of discretion as if it was the first exercise of discretion. He had never had a ruling, I don't know, he may have raised it, but he had never had a ruling from the circuit court on any exercise of discretion, either the first one or the second one, because the court decided the case on a due process claim the first time. So whichever way he wants to characterize this, he had never had the circuit court look at its exercise of discretion for the second time. And that's the theory under which Meyer exists, and that's also the theory under which 809-30 requires post-conviction motions to be filed for issues that haven't previously been raised. So the problem here is that even if the court had considered its first exercise of discretion, we have a second exercise of discretion. But the court had never even considered its first exercise of discretion.
Okay, and suppose that I have two questions. One, is it too late to go back and say to the court?
Well, it's too late without any court action. But
which court action?
Well, either this court or the Court of Appeals could have extended the time to file a post-conviction motion.
What's the time to file a post-conviction?
Well, normally the time is 60 days from the filing of the last transcript. But that time limit is not jurisdictional, and this court or the Court of Appeals can extend the time. And, in fact, I think that's probably what should happen in this case. This court, I think the important point from our point of view is that the circuit court ought to have an opportunity to look at its exercise of discretion as it would have had there been a proper post-conviction motion filed. This court has the authority to extend the time to file a post-conviction motion. It ought to do it, send Mr. Walker back to the circuit court, and have him file his motion.
And what's the source of that authority?
The source of your authority to extend is 809-62, I believe it is, but I'm not sure of the number. Mm-hmm. It's the normal time section at the end of the Rules of Appellate Procedure.
So you want this court, if I understand your position, you want the court to say that the trial court never had an opportunity here to review its own exercise of discretion. You, defendant, go back under an open time period under 809-60, whatever it is, and then Judge McMonagle will look at it. And assuming he stays with 12 years, we don't have to go back to him again. No, then we can appeal. Time for appeal is still okay because
right.
We've got a new...
Yeah, because the time for appeal would run from the denial of the post-conviction
okay.
motion.
So he says, okay, you're right, 11 years, 6 months, right? So he enters an order, 11 years, 6 months. Now, I'm assuming that you would then say you got to go back before you appeal 11 years, 6 months, you got to go back to McMonagle and say, we think you abused your, I'm sorry, we erroneous exercise of discretion, only knocking off 6 months, please reconsider, right?
Yeah, yes. And I would say, why would this be different than if the Court of Appeals did that? And if the Court of Appeals did that, we would surely require...
Did what? What
said,
is that?
Said to Judge McMonagle, let's take your fact scenario, except instead of the circuit court doing it, the Court of Appeals does it and says, we think knocking off 6 months was an erroneous exercise of discretion, remanded again. Well, if that happens, then I think for all the same reasons. The new exercise of discretion should have a new post-conviction motion.
But isn't there a difference, Mr. Weinstein? I mean, when you're dealing with a resentencing, and I forget who it was here in the court that used the term do-over, but you are dealing with a do-over. You're starting from scratch, and I think you're correct that there's a question of whether or not sentencing discretion has been examined by the trial court. But the point is to get back and have the trial court consider what it has done. When the trial court either grants or denies a motion for modification, it has already been before the trial court, and the trial court has had an opportunity to state its reasons. Isn't that different from resentencing?
Well, that hasn't happened in this case.
No, but assuming, using the Chief's hypothetical.
Which is why I use those hypotheticals.
That may be true. I did not look specifically, and I have not found any cases that talk about, well, if you file a 973-19-1A motion, let's say, and the court does, in fact, resentence, do you have to then file another motion? And I would be comfortable going with however that question has been resolved. If it has, I don't think it has. The problem, it seems to me, with that procedure, it would make perfect sense to me in a 973-19-1A situation to say, no, you've done it once. The court's reconsidered it. It is a motion to modify. It's granted it in part and denied it in part. That's adverse to you in some aspect. So up you go. The problem with that from a 973-19-1B point of view, it seems to me, because 973-19-1B rolls into 80930, is you have specific language in the rule, 80930H2H, which says, if you haven't raised this issue before, you are required to file a post-conviction motion. And if the court exercises its discretion differently and enters a new judgment, then it seems to me there's no way around that language. It is an issue that has not been raised previously.
Well, the reason I keep pressing on the examples I gave is to make the point that Justice Butler is making. Do you treat a vacation of the sentence and a new sentence differently than you treat a modification of a sentence?
If you use the modification of the sentence in the sense of 973-19, yes. The problem is that language is somewhat problematic because we use it in the new factor situation too. But if you distinguish it as 973-19 as a modification and 80930-2H as a post-conviction motion, then yes.
I'll tell you, I've read the criminal appeal statutes a number of times, and I'm never sure that I understand them. I find them very complicated.
I think they are, and they're very complicated compared to other states.
Yes, and in fact, it's somewhat disgraceful because it's a trap. I mean, here we are fussing around with this, with all due respect to all counsel, when I'm wondering in the long run in the criminal justice system what differences it make. Now, I totally agree with the case law that says give the trial judge an opportunity to correct an error. It saves a lot of time for everybody. I totally agree with that. But when you talk about 973-19A, 1A, 1B, we talk about 80930, 80962, whether you have transcripts, whether you don't have transcripts, I mean, it's all a muddle. What are we going to do about it?
Well, in this case, it seems to me that if you agree with the proposition that the trial court, that it makes sense to have the trial court consider for a second time its exercise of discretion, then this case was correctly decided by the Court of Appeal, and to resolve the harshness to Mr. Walker, what we ought to do is send him back with a post-conviction motion by extending the time to file the post-conviction motion.
He hasn't served 12 years yet, I gather.
I think it's consecutive, too, so I don't think he's even begun this one. But in any event, the reason that these rules are set up this way, and as far as I know, we are the only state that does it this way. And we do it this way so that we can consider ineffective assistance counsel of counsel claims and motions to withdraw pleas as part of the direct appeal rather than the way they do it in most states, which is as a collateral attack on the judgment. So in most states, the time for filing the appeal runs from the entry of judgment and it proceeds like our civil procedure where all the transcripts are ordered after the judgment and notice of appeal have been filed. So all of the stuff that we do as part of the direct appeal ends up being a second proceeding collateral attack. And we avoid that with our statute, but the price we pay is that the time for filing the notice of appeal varies depending on all these things. And this becomes important in federal habeas, so I have to have a thing that I print out, and I have to look at it every time I do a federal habeas case to determine when the appeal became final. Because it is very difficult to figure out. And the easy, simple way is to do it the way the other states have, but that would take a major rule change.
Well, has the Attorney General's office considered going to the Judicial Council? I mean, they're doing major rule changes in appellate practice, and maybe you and the Public Defender's Office and Defense Counsel can agree on something that would be simple that everybody could understand and we wouldn't need different charts. Do you share your chart?
We ever have done that. I know that we have had a lot of trouble getting agreement with the state public defender over almost anything on the appellate rules.
Okay.
So
that answers that.
And it's such a major. I mean, I've always assumed that all of this stuff was hashed out when we first adopted 80930, and that we had consciously decided that this is the way we wanted to go.
Probably was, but probably no one can remember.
It doesn't help this case.
What the hash was. In your brief, you say, for the above stated reasons, this court should affirm the Court of Appeals' dismissal of the appeal. This is your conclusion. If the court concludes that Walker is entitled to review of his claim that the circuit court erroneously exercises discretion, this court should remand to the Court of Appeals for that review because you didn't, no one briefed that issue.
Right, and also because I assume that if that was the case that you would disagree with me that he was required to file a motion.
Okay, but you really have a third alternative, if I understand.
From our point of view, the importance of this case is making sure that everybody understands that when you have a resentencing, another exercise of discretion in the trial court, that a motion to the trial court is required the same as for a first exercise of discretion. And if it makes sense for the trial judge to review his or her own exercise of discretion the first time, it also makes sense the second time.
Does it make sense this time? What new argument will the defendant be advancing?
I'm not sure I understand.
I wonder if this is kind of full of sound and fury and signifying nothing, you know? That is, he made the argument on October 6th of 2004. That's when the hearing was. What different argument is going to be made if he's required to go back and make another motion for to make some kind of post-conviction?
Well, he's never made the argument he made in the Court of Appeals on why the Circuit Court erroneously exercised its discretion has never been presented to the Circuit Court.
Well,
that's the whole problem.
What was his argument there? That's what the issue.
The argument that was presented to the Circuit Court the first time was you relied on inaccurate information.
That was October 6, 2004. That was the argument that was made, right?
That was his argument that was made prior to October of 2004. The October 2004 was the resentencing hearing, October 28th. I'm actually not sure of exactly the date that the trial court granted the motion.
My question remains the same. if you're suggesting that he has to go back and ask the court to reconsider what it did on October 28th
hearing?
Yeah.
The argument that he made to the Court of Appeals about that exercise of discretion has never been presented to the circuit court.
No, I know, but it's the question Justice Brantley is asking you, if I can...
The question is,
what did... I don't have the Court of Appeals briefs with me. They may be...
What did he claim?
Yes. What did he argue to the Court of Appeals?
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't understand. And I'm a little dim because I haven't looked at it since the Court of Appeals briefing was required. But as my recollection was that he believed that without the evidence of the as great a harm to the victim, the 12-year sentence was overly harsh in view of all the other remaining information. I believe Justice Crooks is right. There was some evidence presented about his adjustment in prison, which he viewed as favorable, and thus that rendered the 12-year sentence, which was appropriate the first time supposedly, as inappropriate the second time.
I understand the policy, and I affirm it, that you should give the judge an opportunity to correct the mistake before it goes up. I mean, that makes all the sense in the world to me. But I just can't fathom if there's anything new, any new argument that he would be bringing that he did not already make to the circuit court.
If I understand your question, though, isn't that true of all motions to a circuit court, that you've erroneously exercised your discretion in my first sentence? Because it's almost always a repetition of, gee, I made this argument, you didn't give it enough weight, or based on these particular facts which you considered, this sentence is too long. So, I mean...
No, because the judge could have made a mistake in stating the facts.
Well, yeah, but that's not really an exercise of discretion claim.
Judge, well, yes, it is, because that exercise of discretion is error in facts or law. The judge could have made a mistake in reading the PSI. If there was a PSI, we've had those cases, and that's an erroneous exercise of discretion. So there may be differences, but it may be fortuitous that in this case there isn't.
Well, if you're talking about the judge mistaking information, it seems to me that's not an erroneous exercise of discretion claim. That's a misinformation or sentencing based on inaccurate information, and we've got a separate test for that, which was met in this case. It's not always met. But nonetheless, it's not an exercise of discretion claim. When we're talking about an exercise of discretion claim, it seems to me we're always saying to the circuit court, you know, what I really question here is your judgment on how you did this. And most of the arguments that we see on appeal for erroneous exercise of discretion are pretty much the same as the judge addressed in the original sentencing. So, again, I come back to the fact that if we credit the fact that we're going to give the circuit court a second opportunity or an opportunity to rethink and correct any error in an exercise of discretion, looking at the arguments really doesn't help us much because they are almost always identical.
Well, that may raise an even bigger problem. They're almost always identical. Maybe we're spinning our wheels and wasting a lot of time.
Well, of course, we've been to the place where we've said you didn't have to file this motion, and we've also been to the place where we said you've got to file it, but the circuit court doesn't have authority to decide it, and we've come away from that. So, I mean, if we go back to that, it seems to me we're taking a step into the past. But I think that was the concerns that Justice Brantley and the Chief has expressed here were exactly the concerns that motivated the court originally to say you don't have to file one to begin with. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And not all the cases are alike.
Well, I guess you can. I'm not sure it's a good idea.
Okay.
If there are no further questions.
I do have one question. My understanding of the genesis for both rules, when you didn't have to go back and when you did have to go back, stemmed from pre-revision of the appellate court system and the development of the Court of Appeals, which was at Pulaski and Corpella, both predate the change in the rules, creating the Court of Appeals,
right,
and predate the creation of 80930, and 80930 predates the creation of 97319, which I believe was in 84.
Right.
So, given the statutory construct that Mr. Repholz has advanced here, that you've got two different statutory procedures here, you got the 80930, you got the 97319, and given the fact that those statutes and rules post-date our prior holdings, should we not revisit this and just view the statutes using a state statutory construction approach that, one, the expedited procedure in the 97319 is not meant to displace other rights. I think that's the history of that. And then, two, you've got the 80930 procedure under sub 2, I think, J, I think, was the argument that the defense advanced for bringing this up. Should we not just go back and just relook at our statutes and see what the statutes and the rules require, not based upon the fact that the old cases really predate the creation of these rules?
Well, you certainly could do that, and that's certainly justification for it. But I think the end result is that when you look at the plain language of the rule, and when you look at the historical development of the rule, you end up at the same place, which is the rule 80930 especially, and except for 80919 or 97319(1A), everything goes through 80930. So when you get to 80930, I don't think the language gives much wiggle room. It requires a motion for any issue which has not previously been raised in the trial court. And it's pretty except for insufficiency of the evidence, and it's pretty unambiguous. But even if you say it's ambiguous and you start looking at the history, all the judicial comment says the same thing, that the purpose here is there used to be a procedure where you had to raise, and actually, prior to 80930, this was the case, you had to file a motion even if you had raised the issue in the trial court the first time. So, I mean, I'm not sure where going back in history really helps us very much at all. But clearly, all the judicial counsel comments about 80930 originally and all the amendments since all say the purpose here is to have motions for any issue the trial court hasn't previously considered presented to the trial court in a post-conviction motion. And so it seems to me you end up at the same place. And Meyer really, although it's not required the same way that 80930 requires it, Meyer puts 97319(1A) on an equal footing with everything else, rather than trying to do it the other way, saying, well, it's not really required, we could do away with Meyer. Well, then we'd have two separate, totally separate kinds of proceedings. So, I think what you posit certainly justifies a relook, but I don't know that you reach any different conclusion.
All right.
Counsel, what do we do with the cases that we have where there's a resentencing based on inaccurate information? I'm looking at State versus Lechner. This happens to be 217-392 at page 400. But there are other cases like this where Lechner filed a post-conviction motion challenging his conviction and his sentence. He challenged the sentence imposed by the court, arguing the circuit court had erroneously exercised its discretion by relying on inaccurate information in the pre-sentence report and by ignoring
multiple mitigating factors. After a hearing, the circuit court denied Lechner's post-conviction motion. He appealed to the Court of Appeals for review. I mean, there are a number of cases where there's no intervening motion going back to the court on resentencing based on inaccurate information. What do we do with those cases?
Are those cases where the court granted, the circuit court granted the motion?
In Lechner, the court denied the motion.
Well, of course, if the court denies it, then, yeah, there's no need for...
Resentencing, the court...
Although, as I read State v. Grieve, and that's a 2004 case by this court, a claim that the defendant was sentenced on something other than true and accurate information is a due process claim. It's not abuse of discretion or erroneous exercise of discretion. I readily admit that we all the time see those arguments intertwined. Analytically, they're very different.
Several cases that are just like Lechner, where they ask for a resentencing, the court doesn't change its sentence, and then there's a direct appeal.
Right. And if that happens, that's true. That's correct. But then there's no new judgment and nothing to trigger a new running of 80930. The issue has been presented to the circuit court, and the circuit court has decided it. And then it should go up. But the problem here is that's not what happened.
Maybe the problem here, it's hard to understand what happened when the court finishes its transcript of the resentencing hearing on August 6, 2004, and says, the court believes the sentence imposed the last time remains is appropriate this time. You know, so it's hard to really... Things are all kind of blurred, it seems to me,
well,
in this situation.
It may well have said that.
Last paragraph of the hearing.
But in fact, what he was doing, he may have thought he was doing a motion to modify, but I don't think that's what he was doing, because he had agreed, that both parties agreed and the court agreed, that he had used inaccurate information the first time. And I don't think you can, and I think that's an automatic erroneous exercise of discretion. So what if he was really ruling on that, it was wrong. What he really did there, whatever he thought he might have been doing, he granted a motion based on inaccurate information which required resentencing. And that transcript that you just read from is a resentencing. And he certainly understood it enough to say, I'm reimposing the sentence, and he entered a new judgment. Normally, if you have a claim of sentence modification based on erroneous exercise of discretion, and the trial court says, no, I don't think I made a mistake, they don't enter a new judgment. So, procedurally, he did what he was supposed to do, even if he might have mischaracterized it in the transcript.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Mr. Rebels?
I've got three or four things to say. I think I'll start off with addressing Justice Bradley's comment. Mr. Walker has nothing to say further to Judge McMonigal. And Mr. Walker's case is not unlike most of the cases in which I'm involved at a trial level, in which we use 973.19 to go back to the circuit court when we have nothing substantive with which to challenge the sentence, and we're merely asking for the court for maybe additional mercy. We're asking the court to take a look at it out of the goodness of their heart. It's a very difficult motion to write. If in these smaller counties where the courts often will have you in, it's a very difficult motion to do because you don't have much to say.
Mr. Rebholz, yes. When you went to the Court of Appeals, what specifically were you arguing amounted to an abuse of sentencing discretion by Judge McMonigal?
We were, and here's why we did that, and my second point is this. There have been a lot of questions about what Mr. Walker actually sought, and I'm now reading from the document that was filed in the circuit court. And at page 7 of that document, claim C, The mitigating evidence from the final Lake County jury trial is a new factor requiring a sentence modification. And that argument goes on and talks to the court about the new factor frustrated this court's sentencing purposes because the court had initially intended for Mr. Walker to serve a lengthy period of supervised control, it was called, so that he could be monitored and reintegrated into the community following completion of his final like prison term.
Maybe my question wasn't clear enough. What I'm looking at is what Mr. Weinstein told us about a few minutes ago. And he was saying that basically it was his recollection of your brief before the Court of Appeals that you were claiming that Judge McMonigle abused his sentencing discretion and that you were zeroing in on factors like here's this new information on the victim and the medical condition of the victim, and the judge didn't give that any weight. And here's this adjustment in the prison system, and the judge didn't give that any weight. Is that correct, or were there other things?
No, those were the two things that were presented, and that, in fact, and I think this partially addresses the first question. Back when the court was talking to us off the record about what we should do, one of our considerations to further complicate this sentencing analysis is that it made sense for Mr. Walker to agree to be resentenced rather than have his motion heard on a modification basis, because then he would be entitled, we believe, under State v. Carter, this court's case, for the trial court to review positive institutional adjustment, whereas if the court was not inclined to do that, then we would not have been able to present any of that information to the court.
Because it's not a new factor, right?
That's correct. It's not a new factor. So that's a part of the complication and the split-second decision-making that's involved when you factor in all these complexities. Here we are.
Mr. Repholz, I'm looking at the transcript of the sentencing proceeding, and I may have missed this, and I apologize for not catching it before, but according to the transcript on page 2, the trial court noted right at the beginning of the proceeding that this is the third time that this matter is before the court for sentencing. Why is this the third time?
Probation.
All right.
Then he was revoked, and he gave him 12 years, and then he gave him 12 years again on a new factor.
Got it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. I want to thank both Mr. Repholz and Mr. Weinstein for discussing the details of appellate review and re-review by the circuit court and for the all the students, but especially the externs in the Department of Justice. I want to say that you've seen a demonstration that the state's Attorney General's office here represents the public in its prosecution, but that justice does not necessarily mean a total win, that the department lawyers take positions that they think are good for the general system of administering criminal justice in the state. And, for that, I think both the defense counsel and the court and the public should thank them. So, thank you, Mr. Weinstein, and Mr. Repholz. Taking criminal cases in private practice is time-consuming. Lawyers are very often identified with their clients, what the clients do, and if you're here on state public defender appointment, you're not paid very much. So we appreciate your willingness to do this and to do a good job for your clients. So, pardon me?
It's very important for a lawyer to do that.
I totally agree. And for that, I thank you as a representative of all the lawyers who do that. With that, I close the hearing on 04AP2820CR, State versus Roger S. Walker. We will take a few moments and recess so that these students may leave if they wish and other students may come into the courtroom. We are in recess.